really deal with the focus of this lawsuit and this election season.
In the lawsuit over campaign signs in Alaska, the state lays out its case for enforcing a voter-approved billboard ban. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a report says Western Alaska has the highest number of sex offenses in the state for the third year in a row.
I think that the report exists to help folks sort of understand what the reality is on the ground for folks in many of these areas.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A lawsuit challenging the state ban on outdoor advertising along highways is making its way through the courts. While that's happening, small temporary political signs could remain on private property. The state has suggested the court allow it to continue the ban on billboards along public roads. But the state also told Superior Court Judge Herman Walker Jr. that it would agree to limiting some enforcement while he hears the lawsuit. Judge Walker hasn't ordered any changes yet. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska and the group Dunleavy for Alaska sued to stop enforcement of the law. Department of Law spokesperson Corey Mills says the lawsuit shouldn't stop the state from continuing to enforce Alaska's nearly 70-year-old ban on highway billboards. Voters reaffirmed the ban in a 1998 ballot measure.
It's the state's position that in order to uphold the intent of voters to not have billboards on Alaska's highways, that we should really deal with the focus of this lawsuit and this election season, which is the small temporary political campaign signs that people tend to put on their private property.
The state suggested that it continue to allow signs that are smaller than 4 feet by 8 feet. It would continue to enforce the ban on signs said to affect public safety. The three major candidates vying to become Alaska's next governor debated permanent fund dividends and other issues in Juneau today. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
How to pay for the state government, as well as for permanent fund dividends, was a point of big division for the candidates. Governor Bill Walker, who's an independent, asked Republican former state senator Mike Dunleavy about $1.1 billion in budget cuts he said he would make in January 2017. Walker noted that Dunleavy has declined to say how he would cut specific departments.
Nearly every department, you said no. So could you tell us today where's that $1.1 billion cut you've been talking about so much? It fits on a bumper sticker, but I'm not sure where it comes from.
Dunleavy isn't proposing the cut this year. He says the state must develop its natural resources more to generate revenue. Dunleavy asked Walker if he would handle his veto of dividends 2 years ago differently today.
Cutting that PFD in half, causing a number of small businesses to fail, as well as individuals having to really take a look at their finances and reconfigure how they were going to manage through that process. Knowing this, would you do anything different?
Walker says he doesn't look back, but that the veto allowed the permanent fund to grow and keep dividends secure in the future. Democratic former U.S. Senator Mark Begich questioned Dunleavy's plan for paying out PFDs. Dunleavy supports the traditional formula for dividends, which would raise their cost by $840 million this year. Begich says this will lead to unsustainable draws on permanent fund earnings.
When you lay out your numbers, at some point something's going to give. And what will give is the earnings reserve. And at some point it will be to zero, which means your plan does not have a long term. It's a short term. I get it. I see what you're saying. But the long term plan for the next generation is there will be no money to help service not only the government, but also there will be no dividend.
Begich's dividend plan would cost roughly $300 million more than the state will spend on PFDs this year. Begich says he has a track record at the federal and local level of working with politicians who disagree.
You know, if you have to work with Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz and everyone in between, working here in Juneau is not that hard. I'm going to tell you that. And if you've been an assembly member and you've survived that, everything is a piece of cake.
Walker defended his record, noting that the projected gap between what the state spends and what it raises has fallen from $3.7 billion to $700 million.
I refer to it as the fiscal house is on fire, and it was on fire. And Lieutenant Governor Mallott and I ran to it. Lieutenant Governor Mallott and I know that the fire is put out because these two folks want to move into the house that now we put the fire out of.
Dunleavy says he would look to lower the limit on how much the state government can spend.
We have to revisit that appropriation limit. We have to look at a way to cap the size and growth of this operating budget. If we don't do that, there is no fiscal plan. There is no amount of PFD that can keep up with it.
The candidates addressed some issues of particular interest to Southeast Alaska. They all said the capital will remain in Juneau. Dunleavy says he supports extending the road north from Juneau. Walker says the proposal is flawed because it wouldn't connect with other roads and that addressing the remaining budget shortfall is a bigger priority. Begich says he wouldn't restart the road project, adding that there should be a statewide approach to building roads and other projects. The candidates varied widely in their assessments of President Donald Trump. On a scale of 0 to 10, Begich gave Trump a 4-, which he revised to a 2 after the debate. Dunleavy gave Trump an 8, and Walker gave him a 5. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Negotiators from Canada and the United States have reached a tentative deal over Pacific salmon. That's according to John Field, Executive Secretary of the Pacific Salmon Commission in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The proposed amendments to the treaty, and there are a number of them, have been transmitted to capitals, Ottawa and Washington, D.C., for review and consideration by the national governments.
That was on August 24th. But the 10-year annex of the Pacific Salmon Treaty isn't official until it's signed by both countries. The treaty has governed salmon catches, research, and enhancement in Alaska, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia since 1985. It's renegotiated every 10 years. No details have been released on the latest agreement, which would last until 2029. But Field says he's confident it'll be approved before the current deal expires at the end of this year.
The salmon treaty has a long history with these two countries. It's in their mutual interest to have the treaty enter into force, and I'm confident that both countries are doing everything they can to have them enter into force on time.
In Southeast Alaska, the agreement impacts primarily Chinook, sockeye, and coho fisheries. It's expected to contain provisions on how to conserve Chinook, which have seen dramatic declines. One of Alaska's largest and most active volcanoes is restless again, prompting scientists to issue an aviation advisory. Alaska Volcano Observatory scientists increased the threat level of Mount Veniaminoff from yellow to orange Tuesday. That color designation indicates that sudden explosions could send ash above 20,000 feet and threaten international air travel. The observatory's coordinating scientist, David Fee, says the volcano became active Saturday. Fee says small ash emissions seen rising to 10,000 feet prompted the threat level change. The volcano erupted for several months in 2013. Other recent eruptions occurred in 2005 and between 1993 and 1995. Veniaminoff is about 500 miles southwest of Anchorage on the Alaska Peninsula. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, one of the women who keeps bears and people separate in Haines.
I'm supposed to protect the people from the bears, but really the bears need protection from the people because they get way too close.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Strongheart's Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Western Alaska has had the highest reported rate of felony-level sex offenses in the state for at least the past 3 years. That's according to the Alaska Department of Public Safety. The state compiles data of reported offenses in the Felony Level Sex Offense Supplemental Report. The report for 2017 was released last week. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The state has been putting out the felony-level sex offense supplemental report for 3 years. All 3 years, Western Alaska has ranked as the most dangerous region in terms of reported sexual violence. The Western region includes Bristol Bay, and it's comprised of coastal areas from the Aleutian Islands to the Northwest Arctic Borough. The department's data shows the rate of reported felony sex offenses in these areas is more than twice as high as the rest of the state. In Western Alaska, the most common victim age was 13 years old, 2 years younger than the most common victim across the state. The most common suspect age in Western Alaska was 28. In 80% of the offenses reported in the region, the victims were Alaska Native. Jonathan Taylor is the communications director for the department. He said the report is meant to be a barometer to give a clearer picture of the prevalence of sexual violence across the state. It doesn't explain why those crimes happen.
I think that the report exists to help folks sort of understand what the reality is on the ground for folks in many of these areas. But it doesn't answer the questions of why their rates are what they are. I think there can be many factors that can contribute to different types of crimes. And this perhaps serves as a starting point to start conversations and investigation and research into why these rates are what they are in different areas of the state.
Statewide, the department found that the number of incidents decreased slightly last year as compared to 2016. However, the number of victims increased by more than a quarter. Taylor said that more detailed reporting by law enforcement agencies could contribute to the apparent increase in victims. He said some agencies in previous years had not specified how many victims were involved in an incident. They may now be including that information in multi-victim cases. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Governor Bill Walker's administration is looking for Alaskans to serve on an advisory committee that will shape the future of Tongass National Forest. In August, the U.S. Forest Service announced it would be considering building new roads in the wilder parts of the Tongass. This is different than the federal legislation most states have to follow. The committee will discuss which areas in the Tongass could have new roads. Alaska's congressional delegation has said having enough access to timber and mining opportunities is a priority. The governor's office says it's seeking applications for a diverse panel of up to 13 people, including Alaska Native regional corporations and tribes, local governments, environmental groups, and interests from tourism, mining, energy, timber, and fishing. Meredith Trainer from the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says her organization is still deciding whether they'll apply.
Of course, I think any environmental group that's paying attention to these issues is going to consider putting their hat into the ring to be able to be at the table.
Trainer is skeptical the governor's office will be able to select a balanced committee to oversee the future of road building in the Tongass, since it was the state who asked for an Alaska Roadless Rule exemption in the first place. But a spokesperson for the Alaska Division of Forestry says the agency is committed to bringing a broad range of objective people together. It's expected the group will be appointed in the next 2 weeks. Donlin Gold would need to destroy two creeks in order to build its proposed gold mine, and now it has the permits to do it. KYUK's Teresa Kotsarilis has more.
Donlin Gold received 13 different fish habitat permits from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game last week. The mining venture needs the agency to sign off on pretty much anything they want to build that could impact local fish habitats. So last Thursday, ADF&G gave the green light to a dozen or so different aspects of that construction.
There's several bridges, so there's a permit for each one of those. And there's the permits for the mine itself.
Audra Brazzi is Fish and Game's regional supervisor, who signed off on the permits. She says the massive pit of Donlin's proposed mine will eventually swallow up American Creek, and its tailings facilities will dam and fill in Anaconda Creek nearby. Both tributaries are populated by silver salmon and other species. Brazzi says her agency has okayed the destruction of those fish habitats, provided that Donlin restores damaged habitats elsewhere.
The area where Donlin mine is proposed to go in, it has been mined before. It's something that's been impacted. They're going to try and improve that habitat. and that's going to mitigate for the American Creek going away.
The state's decision infuriated those Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta residents who oppose the mine. YK Delta villages rely on the Kuskokwim River and its tributaries for subsistence fishing, and Donlin Gold's critics argue that the project could damage the region's food supply. Last July, a half dozen tribes sent a letter to Governor Walker requesting that state agencies consult with local tribal governments before issuing any further permits. Unlike some of the other permits Donlin Gold's received recently, fish habitat permits are not open to any public comment period, so the community will not have a chance to respond to that decision. The Kuskokwim River feeds our families, Bethel resident Bev Hoffman wrote in a press release yesterday on behalf of the activist group Yukon-Kuskokwim River Alliance. It has shaped our culture over millennia, yet with the swipe of a pen, the Walker-Mallott administration has decided to wipe out large swaths of fish habitat without even talking to us. Donlin Gold wouldn't be able to build this mine without these permits, and it might have been harder for the corporation to get them after November's election. The Yes for Salmon ballot initiative would strengthen protection for salmon habitat. Donlin spokesperson Kurt Parkin says the corporation still isn't sure how the ballot initiative would impact their permitting process if it were to pass.
I think it's safe to say that it's going to be an attorney's dream, because nobody knows for sure whether or not there's a clear path to getting a permit until you, in some cases, challenge it in court.
By getting its fish habitat permits now, Donlin Gold is avoiding any new regulations that could be enacted if Yes for Salmon passes, not to mention any ensuing litigation. Parkin and Fish and Game's Audra Brossi both insist that the ballot initiative had no impact on the agency's decision to issue the permits last week. The permits have been in the works for years, says Parkin, and it's just a coincidence that Fish and Game signed off on them now. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
An Alaskan from the sport fishing industry has been appointed to the International Pacific Halibut Commission, or IPHC. Richard Yamada was appointed to the commission along with Robert Alverson of Seattle, who currently serves as one of the U.S.'s three commissioners. Yamada owns Shelter Lodge, just about 5 miles outside of Juneau. He's been involved in the charter fishing industry for 37 years and currently serves on the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Juneau Douglas Advisory Committee. He also serves on the National Marine Fisheries Advisory Committee.
And we get together several times a year. We make recommendations about anything dealing with the marine life to the Secretary of Commerce. And so this work at the IPHC really falls in line with that. I mean, it's something dealing with fisheries on a national and now international scale.
Historically, commercial fishermen, processors, and government employees have served both the U.S. and Canada on the commission. Yamada says despite his background, the goal on the commission will remain the same.
At this table, the IPHC, we're there to really look at managing a total entire stock in a sustainable fashion. So the motivations might be different, but we're working together at that level to really look at a sustainable fishery for generations to come.
Yamada takes over Commissioner Linda Benkin's seat, who has served on the commission since 2016. Yamada will be joining the commission at a fickle time in its history. U.S. and Canadian commissioners have been at odds over cuts to catch limits and the distribution of the catch between regulatory areas in both countries.
Last year, we had some issues between Canada and the United States coming to agreement on catch limits. And I was there at the meeting, but I was not privy to, you know, the negotiations behind closed doors. So I'll probably be introduced to that very shortly.
Commissioners have been meeting informally to work out some of those differences this summer, though it's unclear if they've reached an understanding.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message is sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Like much of Alaska, the mountains and woods around Haines are home to many bears. And for the most part, people try to avoid them. But there's one spot where people seek them out. Bears fishing in Chilkoot River draw spectators throughout the summer and create a big safety concern. There are several people working to keep the convergence of the animals, fish, and humans controlled and safe. KHNS's Abby Collins spent some time on the river with one of them.
Jamie Grubb steps out of her white and green Alaska State Parks truck around 6:30 a.m. and almost immediately spots a bear in the river.
It'll move. See it moving?
No.
It's a chilly morning. The river and the road beside it are still in the shade. And Grubb, who works as a bear monitor for parks, sips hot coffee to keep herself warm.
What I do is I protect the bears from the people. I'm supposed to protect the people from the bears, but really the bears need protection from the people because they get way too close. People get extremely close to the bears.
This early in the morning, it's still pretty quiet on the often busy corridor. Few humans, that is, but around a dozen coastal brown bears come and go looking for fishy breakfast. Later in the day, it can get really crowded with visitors and congested with their vehicles. And the bears frequent the weir, a tool used by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to count fish returning to the river. Fish and Game provides support for bear monitoring as well.
It's much easier for the fish or the bears to pin the fish up against the weir than it is to chase them upstream and fight the current also.
Grubb stands in the road on one side of the weir and communicates with a Chilkoot Bear Foundation board member on the other side by handheld radio.
You have who coming down?
Speedy coming right down the road.
Lovely!
Speedy's a Chilkoot River regular. She and her three cubs parade confidently past cars, RVs, and photographers.
I love how this bear just owns the road. She just owns everything. Here she comes.
Grubb is making sure cars don't pass through the section of road in front of the weir while bears are in or approaching the corridor.
Nobody comes across right now. We got the little single bear, and here comes Speedy. She sees her.
And even when there aren't bears in the road, she often stops and talks to drivers before they pass through the area.
Good morning. This is another part of my job.
Grubb has had this job for 2 summers, and she said she's never seen a dangerous situation arise between bears and humans out here. But she says those could come up without this kind of control. Grubb is very comfortable in the presence of bears. She says it's important to understand their behavior.
I tell people all the time, like, we're not a food source for them. We're just more like mosquitoes. We're in their way. We're just an irritant.
Grubb says it's important to move out of the animal's way and give them plenty of space, especially sows with cubs. Near the Chilkoot Weir, visitors are instructed to stay behind a designated line.
I have photographers that come and they hide in the bushes and camouflage and they scare me, and I'm like, if you're scaring me, you're going to scare a sow with cubs and then it's going to be all over for you.
Grubb pays close attention to the bears, scanning the road and the river, monitoring their behavior.
Oh, here comes that little girl again. Honey, she's still fishing. You're not going to be able to get there. But see, she knows there's fish there, so she's going to keep trying. Poor thing. Cute little thing though, huh?
There are a lot more bears around this year compared to last, says Grubb.
Last year, there wasn't as many bears around because there was so much fish. And this year, there's 25 bears.
The Upperland Canal saw a strong return of sockeye this summer. But right now, Southeast Alaska is experiencing a very low pink salmon run. The Haines Borough is closely monitoring the congestion that comes with tourism season at Chilkoot River. Earlier this year, the Haines Assembly placed a moratorium on new tours looking to visit Chilkoot. And recently, Fish and Game installed an electric fence on the weir in an effort to protect the employee counting fish. As for the day-to-day operations, Grubb says keeping bears and humans safe is a, quote, family effort, with many different people and groups contributing. It's important to remember that sometimes bear behavior can be unpredictable. Knowing what to do if you encounter the animals is critical if you spend time in bear country. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
controversial film about a metals mine in Southeast Alaska has been posted online after months of touring film festivals and a threat of legal action by the mining company. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
Irreparable Harm takes a critical look at a metals mine on Admiralty Island.
Greens Creek is an underground silver mine that generates over 2,000 tons of ore per day.
The 20-minute video was commissioned by the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, or SEAC, which claims the mine is polluting Hawk Inlet with heavy metals like mercury. The film takes its name from legal language repeated in the video by the mine's chief spokesman, Mike Satry. He describes the environmental standard under which the mine operates inside Admiralty Island National Monument.
We can meet all of our permits, but if a decision is made that we are having irreparable harm, then we would lose our ability to lease monument land.
In the film, SEAC staff scientist Guy Archibald points fingers at regulators.
It's my belief that the mine will do what's required of them. They've done everything that the state and federal agencies have asked them to do. They've even gone above and beyond. It's the state agencies whose duty it is to protect the public trust that's not requiring the mine to do what they should be doing.
Absent from the narrative are regulators defending the mine's permits. Archibald said that wasn't the filmmaker's wish.
When doing the movie, we asked various agencies if they wanted to participate in the movie, if they wanted to put their point of view, you know, on the record in the video, and for various reasons, they declined.
Greens Creek Mine spokesman Mike Satry released a statement Thursday saying accusations made of the film have been refuted multiple times by state regulatory agencies. The film also faced a legal challenge. Earlier this year, lawyers for the mining company sent a cease and desist letter, claiming that the film's use of a Hecla promotional video violated copyright law. Attorneys from the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco defended the use of the footage under the fair use doctrine. The mining company's legal threat was withdrawn. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Finally tonight, a correction to a story yesterday about expected impacts to Fairbanks Borough schools from the stationing of F-35 fighters at Eielson Air Force Base. The name of the consultant quoted in the story is Shelley Wade. Wade works with Agnew Beck. That's the borough's Eielson Regional Growth Plan contractor. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Jacob Resnick, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel, and Abby Collins in Haynes. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. You know your teenager is struggling. Friends have changed. Grades have dropped. And when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.